Anything you want to bring up with me about the basic organization course? Was anybody not here in the first class? You have a link to the class website, and you're all logged in. Okay. Then I guess the next question I have, since I set up the syllabus, I had a research meeting that was moved to Tuesday afternoon from 1 to 4. So I have to move my Tuesday afternoon office hour to 4 to 5. So that's not on the syllabus yet. It's not, I need to change that on the website, but I want to let you know about that. Having said that, of course, if you want to meet, just send me an email and I'll leave. It doesn't, I'm not married for Tuesday from 4 to 5. But officially, it's going to be that time. Anybody have any lingering questions about stuff from the last four lectures? Anything bothering you? I didn't get emails, I didn't get anonymous notes or whatever. So is there anything unresolved that you're really bothered about? Okay.
Good.
Technically, how did that, I mean, four in a row is a lot, I understand that, and I do apologize about that, but did things go okay? Any technical issues with the elections? Yeah. All right.
Good. So, if everything works so well, I'm going to try some... How many of you actually brought your little PRS doohickeys? Okay, so we've probably got enough to do this. So let's give this a shot. So what I want to do is see if we can actually get it to work. Thank you. I'm not storing anything, so I just have to get through this initial auto start stuff. No, no grid, no chart, advanced question, no. Let's see if that works. Hello? It's not happy. Doesn't look very happy today. Not sure what the problem is, and I don't want to waste our time with it, so we're going to do it a different way. Let's see what we do. Let me just try a couple of checks on something. Okay, so we have this charge distribution, we have a point P, and I'd like to know the direction of the electric field at point P, and you see that I have a bunch of different vectors, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And so what I would like for you to do is look at that for a moment and decide which vector you think best represents the direction of the electric field at point P, and then I'm going to go through the numbers with you with your eyes closed, and I'd like you to just raise your hand when I get to the number that you think is the right direction for the electric field. Okay, close your eyes. And if you don't close your eyes, just remember I have a laser pointer. Okay, vector 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. All right, so you can open your eyes now. Most of you said 1, a number of you said 4, and there was some scatter in the rest. So the direction of the electric field is going to be the direction of the force on the positive test charge put at point P. All of these charges basically are going to be pushing a positive charge here in the direction of vector 5. These charges are going to be pulling a positive charge here in the direction of vector 8, sort of that symmetry. If I have, as you just are supposed to infer from my lovely artwork, that the density of charge here and here is basically the same, then you've got these two force vectors and these part to the left and part to the right components of the 8 and 5 vectors will basically cancel out. And you'll be left with an addition, so you'll have stuff moving in that vector 1 direction. Okay? Alright. So let's see, let's try a different one. Let's say that I have a spherical charge distribution. And we're going to say that rho, the charge per unit volume, is constant inside that spherical charge distribution out to big R zero. And let's suppose you use Gauss's law to find the electric field inside of the radius R zero. And I would like you to look at these expressions, take a moment, and decide which one you think is correct. It's fair to use a consent paper if you want.
close your eyes. Well, first look and make sure you know which number corresponds to one you think it is. And close your eyes and tell me if you think it is number one, number two, number three. Okay. You open your eyes again. We had a number of hands go up for number one, only a couple for number three, probably most for number two. So let's think about this. We have Gauss's law, and we're worrying about, we want to determine Gauss's law at a radius inside of big R0. So we choose the hypothetical Gaussian surface to fit the symmetry, in this case, the spherical symmetry, with little r, which is less than this big R0, because we want to choose some arbitrary radius that is in the region where we're trying to evaluate the electric field. Then the left-hand side is within that Gaussian surface at little r0, what is the integral of E dot dA, that is the flux through that surface at little r0. So that, because of the symmetry of the problem, E dot dA is E times dA, you can pull B out of the integral, and then we basically are looking at the area of this sphere, which is 4 pi little r squared. So that would be this, okay? And then the opposite side of Gauss's law is the Q enclosed, and you want to look at the charge enclosed inside of the small radius sphere. So again, that's going to be rho times the volume of the small radius sphere, not the big one, which is going to be 4/3 pi little r cubed times rho divided by the epsilon naught. So I think 2 is the right answer. Okay, so I really just wanted to throw out a couple of these to get a sense that we weren't totally broken, and I don't think we are. So that's good. I feel better now. So this whole electric field thing is, I hope you're beginning to get an intuitive feel for what it looks like in different configurations. What I have here is a piece of acrylic with painted conductor of this shape and that shape, and I have two leads going on to the conductor, and I can place an electric charge, positive charge on one of these and negative on the other. And then I have a device which has basically some non-conducting crud. That's a technical term. Non-conducting crud. Little beads of plastic or something that are and what will happen is that if I put charge here and here, I'm going to induce a little dipole, a little charge separation on each of these little beads. And they'll begin to orient themselves along the lines. They'll sort of come around along the field lines. Okay, so you see how they've all lined up here? So you can sort of visualize the electric field lines in here. If you have parallel plates, we'll find out, you have an electric field inside and it's zero outside. Here you see edge effects out here, but if you can imagine the plates being really long and wide, you can see that. Thank you.
So now I have different geometry. So this will be like a positive and negative point charge. So we should do it to the dipole. It's not called the field here. So watch what happens when I cause the charge here. Unfortunately, I have a little bead that I use. Okay, so now you're getting that dipole field shape that we've seen before.
Yeah.
Was that exciting or what? I have a good one, but I'm going to bore you for a bit before I get to it, because I can wake you up with it. Okay, just remind me.
Don't let me forget that one. So, okay.
Last time, I wanted to look at these different geometries, and boy, that one didn't come out really good. Wow, that just looks horrible.
It's like the projector's brighter than I've seen it before. I can zoom it, shift it, and focus it, but we're stuck with the brightness, I guess.
Maybe if you zoom in on the computer a little
bit. Yeah, that I can do, but then I lose my freedom to draw around the way I want. See if this works better. Still, it looks horribly bright. I don't know.
Total flux of the surface of the charge is enclosed in the flux. And we've now done some exercises basically using that conceptually. And of course, one of the ways in which it's extremely useful is that you can extract the electric field here easily under conditions of certain symmetries. And that may seem like a big limitation because we're talking about things that are spherical, things that are cylindrical, or planar things. But if you stop and think about it, you can actually construct a whole lot of different shapes out of those three things. And remember that electric fields are vector fields, so they're superpositions. So you can have a problem that has a piece which has spherical symmetry and another piece that has cylindrical symmetry, solve them both separately, and then add those fields together vectorially to get the actual field for the configuration problem. So it turns out that even though it's somewhat limited, these are extremely useful things. It's also important to realize that you can solve Gauss's law in conditions where you can really know what you're doing, like an infinite wire, where you get this beautiful symmetry and you can solve it using the spherical, the cylindrical geometry very nicely, like I think we did in one of my lectures. And that works really well, but you go, well, who the hell uses infinite wires? And the answer is nobody. But the truth is, any straight wire, when you get close enough to the wire, sort of looks infinite. So in the approximation that you're getting close to the wire, you can get a pretty good solution for the electric field. Now we're not going to be in the condition where everything is constant, and there are going to be times when you have to evaluate the charge enclosed, or we're going to have to actually do integrals in spherical coordinates and cylindrical coordinates. And if you continue in physics or engineering, it is almost for sure that you're going to have to learn how to do these types of integrals
using full Angular dependence, and it can get very nasty in time. It's going to be one of the things that will make your life a living hell in a couple of years. But it's sort of fun. At any rate, what we're going to do in this class is we're going to do spherical and cylindrical problems, but I'm going to promise you that we're basically going to do them in one dimension. We're only going to use the radial component. And so there's a way in which I have to we have to look at it to do that. This drawing is so bad, it's hard for me to even refer to it. Is that looking better? Yeah, a little bit better. Okay, so just to remind you that if I have a spherical system, for example, and I think of a volume element, something like this, that is my differential volume. If I want to break that down into its angular and radial components, then what I'd like to do is to take this box and multiply it. Basically, I want to take this side length times that side length times this side length. Well, the one coming out this way is some differential dr, so that's pretty easy. But the angular pieces here are more complex, and when you look at it carefully, and I'm not... Do you want me to take the time to go through that, or did you guys figure this one out? Are you okay? Basically, when you look at it carefully and you take into account S equals R theta, right, which you always have for angular relationships, and you look carefully at this geometry, in the radial direction, you bring in a factor of dr, that's this distance. In theta, you not only, so theta is the angle coming down this way, okay? This arc length is not just theta, or not d theta, it's r d theta, because s equals r theta. And we're really talking here about an arc length, right? So the factor that goes into the little differential volume here is not just d theta, but it is r d theta because of that radial scaling factor you always get in converting from linear to radial coordinates. Similarly, but a little more complicated, we define phi as this opening angle with the x-axis in the xy plane, then here is d phi, and then, so we have basically an r d phi being this arc length, but it's a little bit shorter because you're up here in theta. So you have to project this piece down into the xy plane, and that's where the sine theta piece comes in. So you end up with this r sine theta d phi. And so the differential volume, the volume of this piece in terms of the theta phi and r components, is equal to r squared times sine theta times d theta d phi and r. We'll always have to use that in spherical polar coordinates. Now, that hasn't bought us anything right away, because if we now have to do a problem and sum up all the charge in some spherical formula, right, it's like the rho dv, that's the dv, and we're not done with, I mean, if rho has angular components, you're stuck doing that integral, and it contains this differential law. And that can be bad. So, I will promise you that basically we will not have angular dependence, so we can sort of mentally just integrate those away. And there's, so I'll show you how I do that. Oops. I'm doing the wrong ones. The cylindrical coordinates is sort of the same. I mean, we looked at this last time, so the way that we, in spherical coordinates, if I have integrated out the angular piece, it means if I'm at a little r, for example, and I can say this is a sphere of charge and I want to integrate it over, I have the freedom to choose differential volume dv however I want. And I can think of it this way. It has no angular dependence. So I'm going to take it as the area of a small sphere in here, which is 4 pi r squared, and I'm going to multiply it by dr. And that's why dv becomes 4 pi r squared dr. If you were to go through and do the angular integrals without any angular dependence in the problem, you would find the theta and phi pieces will give you the 4 pi r squared. That is the area of the sphere. Right? So that. So we're mentally, what you can do is always take your dV in these problems, and because we have an angular dependence, think of the differential volume as a shell surface, and you get a volume by going out of dr. So 4 pi r squared out times dr, and that then becomes the dV that you actually integrate. Using the same strategy in a spherical, in a cylindrical problem, what you'd like to do is to choose a differential volume that has the same cylindrical characteristics, but the angular dependence is taken out. So the differential volume would be basically the surface area of a pipe, if you look at this inner piece here, which would be 2 pi r, the circumference of a pipe, times the length. So that's 2 pi r l, okay? And then go out the dr. So dv becomes 2 pi r l out of dr. Okay. And that would be the differential volume that would be useful to use. So if I give you a cylindrical problem, it will have a dependence only on that radial component. And you have to worry, you have to pull out this correct differential piece. You okay with that? All right, so in succeeding courses, and I'm not exactly sure when, maybe 217, maybe in quantum mechanics, they'll start taking out the radial constraint number, and you'll begin to see angular pieces. And it's doable, but the mathematical functions start to get sort of nasty. So let me do a problem for as an example for fun. So let us suppose that we have a cylindrical geometry And let's suppose that the inside here is a non-conducting core. And it has radius big R sub A. And it has plus lambda, so it has a charge per unit length along, which is distributed as rho as a function of little r, so the radius out from the axis of symmetry in the problem, is equal to some constant little a times r. And this would be for r less than r sub a. Okay? And then outside of that, for so there's our inner core, and now we're going to say that outside of that we have a circular piece. So now if we look at it along the axis, it looks circular, and we'll say that here is R sub B, and this is R sub C. So then in the region R, which is greater than R sub B but less than R sub C, we have a conducting sheath or a conductor with no free charge placed upon it. OK?
Okay? And then the problem is to find the electric field in all space. Okay? Yeah, probably should be. R is greater than, wait a minute. Little r is going to be greater than r sub b. Yeah, and it's r sub c is greater than that. Yeah, thanks. Okay, so that's the problem. So, the first thing to do is to think about the regions, and clearly the problem has uniformity inside of little r sub a, and then uniformity in this region, and then uniformity in that region, and then uniformity out there. Basically, there's nothing that distinguishes in terms of the mathematics of the problem. You know, a radius at this point and a radius at that point, everything kind of look the same, and then inside of here. So those are sort of the four relevant regions of the problem. And so let's look now at the first piece, which is going to be some radius which is less than r sub a. And so if we think about that and blow up the core, here's r sub a. What we'd like to do for this problem is use Gauss's law, because this clearly has a symmetry that is useful with Gauss's law for the reasons that we'll see in a moment. And we choose a hypothetical Gaussian surface that has cylindrical symmetry. With a little r, where little r is less than r sub a. Okay? And if we look at it from the side, then oh, can't draw that small. Hello. You almost have to see it to believe it. The thing is set up to get the right orientation on the projector so that I have to have the screen oriented a certain way. But if I have it oriented a certain way and I'm standing here trying to write on it, there's a bank of little quick buttons that you need to do things with right where your hand is. So anytime I relax my hand, I'm going to hit some random button and some crap is going to happen on this. So sorry about that. Oh, wow. So I've killed toolbars somehow. Okay, so what I want is that. Now, where was I? I wanted to put. So the Gaussian surface that we're talking about is right in there. Okay, so it's this little piece right here. And it's a Gaussian surface of length L, so it also basically has some extent going back. It's a cylindrical robot. So this, I didn't say it explicitly, but this you can think of as an infinitely long sort of coaxial geometry. Okay, so just to sort of pound the dead horse a bit, if we think of the geometry of this problem, the charge is spread along here in an infinite way. It has only a radial dependence. There's nothing to give it sort of z dependence along here. So the electric field is going to have to be radial in terms of its geometry. And at a fixed radius, because again everything only has radial dependence, the electric field is certainly going to be the same magnitude as all of those radii, because there's nothing to give it angular dependence in the problem. So there is an argument that's fair to use in this business, which is to say, you know, by symmetry, the electric field is radially outward. And I know it's going out because I say I have a positive lambda, right? The symmetry only tells you that it's radial. Whether it's going out or in depends on what kind of charge you've got. So we know that E dot dA is equal to Q enclosed over epsilon naught, Gauss's law. And in this case, E dot dA is over the entire surface of the Gaussian surface, which means it's the pipe surface of this little orange thing plus the end caps. But because the electric field is radial, E dot dA for the end caps, where dA is out along the line of the axis line of this problem, E being radial, dA being out, they're 90 degrees, so E dot dA does not contribute to this area integral, and you only have to worry about the piece that is projecting out through the surface of the pipe itself, where dA is going out and E is going out. So here, the end caps do not contribute. Right? And E dot dA, now E and dA are in the same direction, so it becomes E times dA, the magnitude of E pulls out, and we have the integral on the left-hand side is just the integral of dA over that pipe surface, which is going to be 2 pi r times L. You might worry about, but I don't have L. I don't know what L is. That's okay, because L will come in on the other side, too. You have to have a closed surface, so you have to invent an L. And so, I didn't do so well on that, but we'll say that here's your Gaussian surface with length L. So what you end up with is E, the magnitude of E, times 2 pi r times L on the left-hand side. And that's going to be equal to Q enclosed over epsilon naught. But what is Q enclosed? That's going to be the amount of charge that is inside this pipe here. And remember that now that the charge is not constant. That's a radial dependence. So we actually have to do an integral in order to determine how much charge is inside that cylinder. So Q enclosed becomes the integral of rho times dV. And in this case, we have cylindrical symmetry. So Q enclosed becomes the integral from 0 out to r, little r, because we're looking at the charge enclosed inside the little Gaussian surface, not the total thing. Rho, which is a function now, which is A times r, and then dV for a cylindrical problem is going to be the 2 pi r L, which is the area of the pipe, out of dr. I'm going to have to figure a way to keep that from happening. Sorry, I'll have to put up with it this class probably, but I'll figure a way around it. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So the A is a constant, 2 pi r L is a constant. So I end up with the integral from 0 to little r of little r squared dr, so that's going to be r cubed over 3. So Q enclosed is equal to A times 2 pi L times little r cubed over 3. So if I take this piece and this piece, then I end up with the magnitude of E is equal to A 2 pi L r cubed over 3 divided by 2 pi r L. So the L's cancel out, and lots of other stuff cancels out. I end up with the magnitude of the electric field is A times R squared over 3 epsilon naught, and it's directed radially out. Okay, you all right with that? So the next region of space, but we're bored right now, so we're going to come back to this.
Let's do this. All right, so I have an electroscope, which remember basically is a conducting rod connected to this conductor up at the top here. Wow.
Oops.
I'm charged.
I'm very charged.
Hello. So we have the gold leaf. If I put charge on this, the gold leaf is repelled from the charge on the conductor and it goes out. So, all right, what I wanted to show you was that in fact that works, as you've already seen, but if I have something that I intentionally put a lot of charge on and I approach this, you can see it rises because the electric field from this is repelling charge from the top, and conductor charge is free to move. So that conductor, that charge goes down, and you see the thing repels. Okay, so very exciting. Lots of fun at fraternity parties. So now, what I'd like to do is I have a metallic cage, and I place it over the electroscope. This conducting cage around this thing, and the electric field cannot penetrate. And this is really good to know, actually, because when you are in a lab trying to do some really sensitive stuff with some electronic device, electric fields, often in the form of different types of radiation, which we'll get to eventually. But electric fields, extraneous electric fields coming from charges and magnets and wires carrying currents all over the place will mess with your circuit. And we call that electronic noise, and it can screw up the measurements. And a way to reduce that is to quite literally take your sensitive stuff and put it in a Faraday, put it in a metal room, and you can reduce the noise that way. Have you ever wondered, when you are popping your popcorn and you are so tempted to sit and stare at it in the microwave, have you ever noticed the metallic screen in the glass? Sort of an inverse Faraday cage, because what microwaves are, and we'll eventually get to, they have a component which is electric fields, and by putting this cage, you basically are keeping it from penetrating out. So that's what keeps you from cooking yourself while you're cooking the pot. So good to know. It's also why if you drop your microwave, you ought to think twice about misusing it without actually testing to see if it has something to do. So you actually want to take that sort of seriously, since the device is basically designed to cook you. So, okay, Faraday cage. There we are. All right, so this problem, remember, coaxial, we've got this piece which is non-conducting that has charge distributed per unit length that goes as a constant A times little r. And then we have a conducting sheath of with some thickness outside of that. We've done the inner piece, so now what we'd like to do is to look at... the region just outside of that. My drawing is getting worse. Sorry, I'm in a hurry, and when that happens, it gets really bad. So what I'd like to do is to choose a Gaussian surface now in this region. So we want to consider the region R sub A is less than little r, which is less than R sub B. In this case, we have all the same symmetry rules apply. Gauss's law applies, and the left-hand side of Gauss's law, the integral V dot VA, everything is the same. The geometry is the same. So on the left-hand side of Gauss's law, we have that E, the magnitude of E, times 2 pi RL is equal to Q enclosed, as the right-hand side, over epsilon naught. Now the question is, what is Q enclosed? We have to actually calculate Q enclosed, which is going to be the integral of rho dV in the cylindrical geometry, but this time, we don't integrate all the way out to little r, because in this region, there is no charge. The charge only goes out to r sub a. So we integrate to get Q enclosed from 0 out to r sub a of rho dv. So that's the integral from 0 to r sub a times r, which is rho, times dv, which is going to be 2 pi r times l dr. So that's actually the same integral we did last time, but now instead of r sub a as the upper limit, instead of little r as upper limit, it's going to be r sub a. So the answer is the same as what we had below, above here, except for this r becomes big r sub a. So q enclosed is equal to A times 2 pi L R sub A cubed over 3. So in this region, E has, we take this piece and put it beneath here and we get E. So E is equal to A 2 pi L over 3 epsilon naught r sub a cubed
divided by 2 pi r l.
So the r dependence is just in here. The charge enclosed doesn't have a little r dependence in it anymore. So the electric field is falling off linearly with r as you move away from that central core, because you're getting away from where that charge is.
And again, it's going to be radially outward. So the next piece of the problem, we've done this piece, we've done this piece. So now we're looking at the region which is going to be r sub c is greater than little r, which is greater than r sub b. So the Gaussian surface you want to choose is in here. So what can you tell me about that one?
Right. I'm in a conductor in here. By definition, the electric field is zero. You say, well, how can that happen? Because I have non-zero electric field out here. Well, because that field will now induce a charge distribution inside this conductor such that it cancels out the external electric field and gives you zero field.
So in this region, E is equal to zero because it's a conductor. Okay? Sure is. It actually is an RB. I'm sorry to say, but okay.
Probably I'm the only person alive who would have known that by looking at that particular symbol on the.
Yeah. Okay. So now we have one more region, which is the outer region. So if we look at R greater than R sub C, we're now going to be with a Gaussian surface out here. And we have no charge at all, net charge on the conductor. We may have an induced charge on the inner piece of it and the outer piece of it in order to get the electric field that cancels the one coming from side, but we have no net charge on it by construction of the problem. So the total charge enclosed for this Gaussian surface is going to be exactly the same as the total charge enclosed for the Gaussian surface we looked at in this region. And the other side is the same for Gauss's law. The left-hand side in the interval VRDA is going to be the same because the geometry is all the same. So you can basically write down at this point that things will look the same. The answer is the same as in R greater than R sub A but less than R sub B region. So the electric field in that point is A over epsilon naught times 3 R sub A cubed over R radially out. Okay?
So I wanted to pick a geometry that when we did the lines and so far, but I wanted to pick a geometry that we had a variable charge distributions in the same form. And we then use this little differential volume for this little integrated option. Do you have any questions on how to do that?
In construction of the problem, I have not placed a net charge on that outer sheath. So all that can happen is if I place this conducting
thick pipe in an electric field. So you can imagine that it has one because we know there's an electric field from this interface. The charge will move around on it until you have an electric field from the charge that's a piece of the conductor that cancels the external electric field. I guess that's the way to think about it. But having done that, it's an induced charge, so I'm taking positive charge and separating it. I'm not putting net charge on that conductor. So I have, in all likelihood, well, I have almost certain, I have certain move charge around in a dipole form. So if I have a positive charge here, I've actually induced a negative charge on the inner surface here and left a positive charge on the outer surface here. But the net charge is zero for that piece, so it doesn't contribute.
No, I mean on the outside.
There is charge sitting on the outside here, but when I sum up the total charge inside this pink Gaussian surface, the net charge here and the net charge here cancel each other out. Okay? I could have placed the net charge on this in construction of the problem. I would have to take that into account. Yeah.
The first section, I didn't quite get why you were integrating from 0 to R. Why was it 0 to R to R?
Okay. So what I would like to do is to... I hypothesize a Gaussian surface at some arbitrary little r in the region where I want to evaluate the electric field. So I hypothesize a Gaussian surface that has a radius little r here, which is nicely hidden, which is less than the big R sub A because I'm trying to find the electric field inside this piece. Okay? Once I say that's my Gaussian surface, then that is where Gauss's law holds. So that's the one I'm evaluating on. So in Gauss's law, I am evaluating E dot dA on that Gaussian surface, which is at little r. So the E is constant, pulls out. It's the integral dA on the Gaussian surface that has little r, which is 2 pi little r times L. And on the right-hand side, I'm evaluating Q enclosed for that Gaussian surface itself. I could define this Gaussian surface to have radius big R sub A, but then I'm finding the electric field at that specific radius. So what I'm really doing is I'm hypothesizing a little general radius inside of in the region that I'm interested in, and then I can solve for it in terms of that little R. Because I could make this Gaussian surface have a smaller radius or a bigger radius in here, and my solution is still true because it has that radial dependence in it. Make sense?
Yeah.
Anything else? Yep.
It's little a.
It's little a what?
Little a.
Little a is just a constant that I threw in at the start of the problem, which it basically carries. It's a constant that carries the units that make things work. So I just define a charge distribution that scales with radius, and A is the little scale factor. And since this has to be in coulombs per meter cubed, and this is in meter, A has to have units of coulombs per meter squared. And it just is some arbitrary number for this in this problem. But we don't like using numbers because the rest of society likes numbers and we want them very uncomfortable. So, actually, I was a math major and I'm a physicist, so people get astounded when I can't calculate simple things like tips and 7 times 12 or something. I mean, it's like, but you've got to understand, that's a number. I don't do numbers. I do symbols. So, whatever. Okay, anything else on this? All right. So if I haven't already, I will drag you through the mud of problems like these because this is one of the places where one of the things, one of the expectations that we have in this course
that you have much less of in 1.2 or certainly 1.14 is doing continuous problems with integrals and stuff. So although I'm going to promise you one dimension, you're going to see lots of continuous stuff. So just get good at these. And as you're doing these problems and workshops and problem sets, if you're having issues with this at all, come ask questions. Okay? We want to straighten that out now, because we're going to be doing continuous problems just out the wazoo in this course. That's one of the things that really distinguishes this class from the others. Okay. So, if you think back to your days in mechanics, you might remember that you could, for example, I guess the example I use is you imagine that you have a ball or a baby or something, and you're high up and you drop them. Right. And you can calculate how fast they're going when they're at the ground by using one-dimensional kinematics, right? And the fact that gravity is a constant if you're close to the surface of the Earth, and, you know. So you can do that. The other thing you can do, which is if you look at the change in energy of the object as it goes from one point to another, and you can talk about how much potential energy it has, right? You have no potential energy, you find zero at the ground, and then you raise it up, you basically get mgh, right? So you go through that calculation, and what you find is that you don't have to pull out one-dimensional kinematics to solve these problems. Like, you can actually just use the change in the height as the change in the potential energy, and use that to then say, okay, I have the baby up at high H and I drop the baby at the bottom of high H, I can set mgh equal to 1/2 mv² and derive the velocity of the baby, right? So you can, right? So energy conserve, energy and conserve, especially with conservative force like a spring or in gravity, becomes an extremely useful quantum. And the same is true in electromagnetism, because electromagnetism is also a conservative force. What I mean by conservative force is that if you don't worry about non-conservative things like friction, then if I have a change in potential energy, it goes into the kinetic energy. And vice versa. So for a spring, for example, I can take a ball that's on a frictionless table, I can pull the spring, it has a certain amount of potential energy stored in the spring, I let it go, and then that potential energy is converted into kinetic energy at the equilibrium length of the spring, and then as it goes back and compresses the spring, it gets converted back into potential energy, it goes back into kinetic, and in the limit of no friction, this just goes on forever. The energy just flows from one to the other. Okay? The same is true for gravitational problems. If I have a mass and I'm in a frictionless situation, you know, if I put in work to bring it up to a certain height and then drop it, the amount of work I put in is going to be equal to the amount of energy, the kinetic energy it has at the bottom of this question. So there are lots of, it's a very useful thing to do. So it turns out that in electricity, we also want to consider energy. So we want to talk about the electric field and energy. So I would like to imagine that we have some positive point charge, and if we have that positive point charge, we know that the electric field is pointing out radially in all directions. And I would like to begin to imagine energy in an electric field by taking a test charge, some little q0, I'll call it,
at point A, and I would like to move it in toward charge plus Q to point B. Okay? And I would like to know how much energy do I exert? To move Q0 from A to B. This is now a mechanics problem, right? This is work. So the energy that I put in is the amount of work it takes to move the charge from point A to point B. So that will be the integral from A to B of F dot ds, where ds is the little differential step along the path that I'm taking. So you can imagine that ds is a little piece like so, okay? And at each point along the way, as I have the little Q0 here, there will be an electric force, an electric field, which is pointing out radially. So there will be a force due to that, which is Q0 times E. And for me to move it in without accelerating, which is typically how you think about these things, for me to move the charge in, I have to exert basically that force the whole way in. So the force that I'm exerting is going to be from point A to point B. So it'll be in the opposite direction. So it'll be like that. So we have to have the directions right in order to get the signs right, because we have this dot product here. So F and DS are along the same direction by construction. So the dot product then becomes F times DS. So this becomes the integral from A to B of F times DS. F is Q0 times E, by definition of electric field, basically. And if I want to think in terms of differential radius, or dr, instead of ds, ds I have currently going positive in the opposite direction of dr. So if I want to convert to dr, I now have to flip the sign. So this becomes the integral from A to B of Q0 times E ds, which is minus the integral from A to B of Q0 times E dr. So the minus sign comes in the variable switch from S to R. E is the electric field of this charge plus Q, which we know to be KQ over R squared. So this is equal to minus Q0, which is a constant, from the radius of point A, I guess, to the radius of point B, since I'm now doing a radial integral, of K times Q over R squared times dr, which is Q times K, little Q0 times K times big Q, the charge of the big Q, times 1 over R sub B minus 1 over R sub A. R sub B is smaller than R sub A. So this quantity is larger than the 1 over R sub A. So this net thing is positive, which it better be, because I'm taking a positive charge Q and I'm asking how much work do I do in order to move it closer to some positive charge over there. I have to put work in to make that happen. Right?
You don't have words with the change in sign of your environment there, is it? No,
there'll be a change in sign in a different place. Because if you're going outward, let's see, there's a force going out due to E, but now to have it go out without accelerating, I have to put a force in
And so there turns out to be a VS is now this way, so you get the negative sign a different way. I find pedagogically when I'm doing it that way, I invariably draw the sign. There's somehow when you're going out, you always drop a sign in front of people. You can do it in an office or your desk very nicely. But invariably I'll drop a sign and I do it that way. It's always like this way.
But there, yeah, you do get the same answer. There's a negative sign that comes in. Okay, so that's a net positive quantity. Now, what we want to do is to think about energy and electric field. So what we did is we now have the electric field. We calculated how much energy it took to go from here to here. And you'll note that it depends on this little Q0. And we don't like that, right? Remember when we were looking at electric fields, one of the nice things about it is we sort of look at the force per unit charge. We want to take the test charge magnitude out, and we want to do the same thing here. So we define something which has different symbols, but I'm going to call it a delta V here. We're going to call it a potential difference. And that's going to be the work per unit charge to go from one point to the other. It's going to be the potential difference between those two points. So the potential difference between B and A is going to be the work per unit charge it took to go from one to the other. And so that's going to be basically this answer where I divide out the little Q. So delta V also might be called VAB, which would be VB, the potential at point B minus the potential at point A, all these different symbols. You mix them and you mix them up so that it's maximally confusing. It's really particularly good if you're giving lectures that use symbols that are different from the textbook. I don't even remember what your textbook uses, but whatever. The units of this are it's energy per charge, right? It's work per charge. So the units of this is in joules per coulomb, which, again, is too simple because we know what it is. So we're going to call this, I'll be done in a minute, a volt, after a guy named Volta, and I think I'll show you his picture next time. So this is known as potential difference. So the idea of potential difference is all tied up with energy. It's the work per unit charge it takes to go from one point to the other. And I want you to have that mantra in your head whenever, because we're going to be using a lot of things with potential. And it's very easy to sort of lose sight over what you really need when we talk about potential and potential differences. In the end, the thing that will always serve you well is if you step back and you say, what I really mean is how much work per unit charge does it take to go from here to there? And then you can sort of visualize it. And that usually sort of gets you back to home base. So I'm out of time, so we'll come back to this on Thursday.
In the book it says voltage is U over Q. I know you said W over Q. The difference is just a sign, but is it negative
W? Yeah, U would be the potential energy of the field, I think. And I'm doing, right now I'm talking about work that I do for the charge.
Okay, that's the work done by the field, which
yeah,
would be the negative.
That's where you get the negative sign in.
Thank you.
Yeah.
How does the embedding change, how is that like created by the current, like the wires embedded in the airplane?
It's just like that. Basically, you can, even though it's not a solid conductor, it more or less can act like a conductor. Mm-hmm. And so, as the electric field tries to penetrate, the charges on the wires will move around to the point where they cancel the electric field in the middle. So on the airplane, it basically does the same thing.
Okay. Very cool. Yeah. Do we hand in homework during lecture on Thursday?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so thanks for reminding me. In fact, if you don't get an email from me, Whether they tell you that, okay. If you would send me an email to remind me, then I'll be happy to send an email out to the class.
A Faraday cage does not keep the electric field if there's a charge outside. If there's a charge inside a Faraday cage, it doesn't prevent an electric field outside of it.
It will prevent the electric field inside the conductor. What will happen is it will induce charge so that you have zero charge inside the conductor, but it will induce charge on the outside so you then will have field out here.
Okay.
So if you have, for example, a charge and then a cylindrical shell, you'll have a charge here. You'll induce charge on the inside. It gives you zero field through the shell, and then that will induce charge on the outside so that you get... You get field outside the shell.
But if there's no charge in the Faraday cage, you can't induce charge inside the Faraday cage.
Right.